Good morning. I think the rain is affecting our crowd this morning. You all brave the elements, and I appreciate that very much. We are going to be focusing on Matthew 16 as we navigate our way through all of the Gospels. Next week is our last class for Volume 1, which will take us through the end of the Galilean ministry. And what Jesus has done is preached in Galilee for nearly 2 years, and he's winding down with that. He's left Galilee. And we're going to be looking at that this morning. So I guess I have to talk a little louder to compete with the rain. It's loud out there. But I'm glad you're here. Thank you. And I know we've got some folks tuning in who weren't able to make it out this morning. We appreciate everyone who is participating. I've been looking at this timeline a lot with you because this is the heart and soul of the material. And if you don't have a print copy, you will remember some of the things that are going on. And I want to make a couple of observations. So this arrow keeps moving to the right as we are moving toward the last week of Jesus' life. Volume 1 covers everything from the arrow to the left. All of the Galilean ministry and to the left. That's Volume 1, the way we divided it. The second half of Jesus' work doesn't take 3 years. It takes just a few months. And the heart of our material, lessons 12 through 15, are about 1 week. That's a bit lopsided, isn't it? Why is that? Why is there so much focus on the last week of Jesus' life? That's a good way to put it. A great many wonderful things and terrible things happen. The Gospels survey the ministry of Jesus, and then they zoom in on Jesus' life during his ministry in Galilee. His, as we call it, the Passion Week. That's when he suffered. That's what's the idea behind that. This last week of suffering, it begins with the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and it will end with Jesus rising from the dead. And we'll get to that in a while. What we're going to do after May, we've got today and then next week, we're going to take a break. Take 3 months off, and then we will resume with Volume 2 of our study. But look how lopsided that is. Isn't that something? During this Galilean ministry, Jesus spends nearly 2 years, and they're marked off by Passovers. And we divide the Galilean ministry into three parts. And what are they called? The early Galilean ministry, the middle Galilean ministry, and the later Galilean ministry. Those are some wonderful technical terms, aren't they? The middle Galilean, you may not be able to read all the fine print there on the screen, but that big red section there, this is when a lot of the events take place. It's about 8 months long. The Sermon on the Mount, actually at the beginning of it, Jesus chooses his apostles, the Sermon on the Mount, walking on water, the bread of life discourse. A lot of great events happen during this middle Galilean period. The later Galilean period is when things begin to wind down. Jesus is then going to go to Judea, then Perea, and then Jerusalem. And that's all Volume 2. So, here we are saying that this is the turning point. This is when Jesus now is winding down his earthly ministry. And he is really focusing on his disciples. And so, as you can see on the screen, there are several parallel passages. Matthew 16, 13 through 20 parallels with Mark 8, 27 through 30, as well as Luke 9, 18 through 21. But instead of turning from one book to another, we're going to hone in on Matthew's account. And so that's why I've asked you to turn to Matthew 16. Look at verse 13. Where are they? You got to speak up this morning because of the rain. Caesarea Philippi. Is that in Galilee? No, it is not in Galilee. The Galilean ministry is over. And this is where we are now. If you look in the middle, that pink region there denotes the country of Galilee. At this time, it is its own country. The other pink area, salmon, is Perea. And that's where Jesus is going to go eventually. He's first going to go down to Judea and preach for about 3 months there. It gets too dangerous for him. And that's when he goes over to Perea. And we'll be getting all into that in volume 2 of our study. The country of Galilee is Jesus' hometown. Did he focus on Nazareth, though? Nazareth is down in this area. This guy's not highlighting for me anymore. I got to figure out the setting there, but it's kind of toward the bottom middle. But Jesus mainly was around the Sea of Galilee. Let me zoom in here. That'll help us. All right. Now what Jesus has done is traveled to Caesarea Philippi. Now he's gone some other places besides Galilee and Judea and Samaria. He has gone to the Decapolis. You see the Decapolis there in the bottom right. He's gone to Tyre, where he healed the Syrophoenician's daughter. Tyre and Sidon, up there in the northwest. So Jesus has gone to Gentile territory, as we've discussed. What does he do in Herod Philip's jurisdiction? Not much, except to focus on his disciples. It seems that at this point in the ministry, Jesus has said, all right, we need to just get off by ourselves. Because Jesus has been in Galilee and preached and performed miracles, he can't go anywhere without folks going, Jesus, Jesus, here, Jesus, I got somebody I need you to heal. And he gets away from all that, it seems, and focuses on his disciples. That's the situation. So let's read together Matthew 16, 13 through 20. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Who do people say that I am? And they said, well, some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say I am? Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. All right, we're going to stop there. Wow. It's not so loud anymore. Need to knock on some wood. All right. Does this sound like Jesus is teaching to the crowds in Matthew 16, 13 through 20? Is he telling everybody, hey, I'm the Christ? No, not at all. Quite the contrary. This sounds like Jesus is pulling his disciples away, his apostles more specifically, and is talking to them. And that's exactly what's happening. This is traumatic. This is dramatic. We'll use that term instead. In verse 16, Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, who in the gospel so far has confessed Jesus to be the Christ? Gentiles, demons, satanic forces. How many believers have? It's curious. Yeah, none that we know of. And here is Peter. And I think Peter is speaking for the disciples. I think they all believe this. He's not saying, well, I believe this and nobody else does, that you're the Christ. I think he's speaking for the 12. They all understand and appreciate. Maybe Judas doesn't, but they all understand that Jesus is the Christ. He is the Messiah. That's the Old Testament term for the New Testament term, Christ. Messiah, Christ, Anointed One. They're all the same concept. And then Jesus responds by saying, I tell you, this is very emphatic, you are Peter. And on this rock, I will build my church. All right. Jesus is making a pun. He doesn't mean this to be funny, ha ha. It's a play on words. And he says, Peter, you are Peter. You are Petros. And upon this Petra, I will build my church. What is Jesus saying here? Is he saying that Peter is the first pope? That's not what's being said here at all. Okay. Well, now Peter isn't a pebble. Peter is a bedrock. It is a rock. It's just a masculine form of the same word as Petra. By the way, petroleum. That's a combination of Greek Petra and Leum, L-E-U-M, which is Latin, and it's oil from rocks. Isn't that interesting? So the person who coined the term petroleum derived it from words that mean rock from I can't remember if it's oil or if it's something else, but I know Petra is rock. Yes, ma'am. Okay, you are Peter, and on this rock. So what is he referring to? Is he referring to a literal rock here? Or is he talking about the confession that Peter is making? And I think that's what you were saying. Peter's not the important one here. He's saying, you're Peter. Who gave Peter his name, Peter? Jesus did. What was Peter's name before he met Jesus? Simon, which is a shortened version of Simeon. It's the same word. In fact, James, the brother of Jesus, refers a couple of times to Peter as Simeon. But this is a name Jesus gave him, Peter. And Jesus is saying, you have said something wonderful. You have said exactly the correct phrase. I am the Son of God. And upon this rock, I will build my church. And I think it's this confession that he has made. Peter has made this foundational statement. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now that's not all. Jesus also goes on, and we're going to talk about that gates of hell here in just a moment. But look at verse 19 first. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth. And sometimes it's translated this way to bring out the tense. You shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. So the English Standard Version I'm reading from has shall be, or I'm sorry, let me look at it again. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. But look at a footnote. I know those of you who are using the ESV, do you see a footnote for whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven? Are you sure you're looking at the right footnote? Yes.
Yeah.
Whatever you declare to be unlawful, is that what you're saying? Okay, so Okay, it's what she said. Yeah, talking about the keys from Isaiah 22. Yes, sir.
Footnote on the ESV says, shall have been bound.
Okay. So look at the screen. This is the running text of the ESV. It says, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound. But it could be translated, and I think it should be translated, as the footnote indicates, as the Amplified also brings out, shall have been bound, or shall have been loosed. And if this is something you're not familiar with, well, now you are. This is a kind of a controversial passage. What's going on here? Is Jesus saying, now Peter, let me tell you something. And the you, by the way, is singular. He's talking to Peter. Whatever you bind on earth, Peter, then God up in heaven is going to say, okay, Peter said it. That means this is how it's going to be from now on. Whatever Peter allows, permits on earth. Peter says, you know, ex cathedra, he says something. And so that means now God has to acquiesce and say, well, okay, I wasn't going to do that, but I guess I will now. Does that sound plausible to you? Or is Peter going to declare, as an apostle, whatever God has already declared in heaven? And that's the idea of this tense. You're going to do this, but it will have already been declared by God. I don't think Peter is being given carte blanche to say whatever it is that he wants to say. And I hate to say, well, we've got to look at the tense here and really emphasize the perfect tense. But this is an important concept, and I appreciate that Bible translations will, even if they put it more simply, here. I've got a hand here, and then I've got tip. So go ahead. Whatever God permits. Whatever God permits or allows. Tip? Exactly. Exactly. So this is past perfect tense. Okay, that's all the English grammar we're gonna go over. But he's saying by inspiration, this man, specifically Peter, will declare what God has already revealed. That's my interpretation. That is my understanding. This keys of the kingdom, though, that's kind of unusual language. Well, did Jesus make that up on his own? Or do you have a footnote? And Antia has already indicated that. Isaiah 22. Is that what you were going to say? Isaiah 22. And this is language about the Messiah who will be given the keys of the kingdom. The keys of the kingdom to unlock whatever needs to be unlocked. That's this context here. Okay. Here's the thing. This is spoken to Peter. Really important, Peter. But then if you go over, which we're not going to right now, but I'll just bring up Matthew 18, verse 18. Where Jesus, in a totally different context, is talking to all the apostles. And he says, truly I say to you, well, this is plural. Whatever you, plural, you all, bind on earth, shall have been bound in heaven. That's how I'm going to render that. And whatever you loose on earth, shall have been loosed in heaven. So has Peter, in Matthew 16, been placed on a pedestal, and he's more important than the other apostles? On first reading, it might seem that way. But then you come over to Matthew 18, and Jesus uses the same language. The only thing that he doesn't mention is the keys of the kingdom. And I have a theory about that. I think it's all wrapped up in the confession. But also, who is the one on the day of Pentecost who takes the lead? Who is the one who stands with the 11 and takes the lead? It's Peter. Is that what Jesus is ultimately referring to? That Peter is going to open the door to the kingdom. And I like to emphasize that the kingdom of God is not the same thing as the church. That's what I was taught when I grew up. But they're awful closely knit together. The kingdom is God's rule, and the church is us. We are the church. We are the covenant relationship of God. It's not an institution or a building. It's a relationship. The kingdom is God's rule. Jesus is our king. in God's kingdom. And that is really emphasized in the Gospels as well as in the letters. We just don't talk about it a whole lot. All right, there's a lot here. Yes, ma'am. You think the key is Jesus? Okay. I think it's denoting authority. Okay.
Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. I will drive him like a peg in a dark place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house.
That's from Isaiah 22.
Okay.
Which is Jesus, you're saying. Okay. I'll have to think about that. Very good. For the sake of time, we're not going to delve into Isaiah 22, but that would be the logical place to go. I want to mention this. The term that Jesus always uses when it's translated as hell, whenever you read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it is always the Greek term Gehenna. Always Gehenna. We think of hell as this fiery place, and indeed it is. But there are four terms that come from the ancient world to describe Gehenna. The Old Testament term is Sheol, the grave, and it's a little different concept. It's where all the dead go in this almost underworld type of existence. The term Jesus is using is the Aramaic word Gehenna. More often, Gehenna is translated as Hades. And that's a different word. I'm sorry, so I shouldn't say this is how it's translated. This is a different concept. This is the Hadean realm, we sometimes refer to it. And this, you know how Greeks and Romans had the same mythology, just different terms? This is Pluto. So Hades is a god in Greek mythology. Well, in Roman mythology, it's the same person as Pluto. Now, here's what I'm trying to get at, and I'm not doing a very good job. There is a cave in Caesarea Philippi that was considered by the Greek-speaking folks as being the gate to Hades. I think Jesus may be speaking to his apostles in view of this cave, or in the area at least where this cave is. And what he says to them is, I tell you, you are Peter, verse 18, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Gehenna. You see that big hole right there that leads to Gehenna? Gehenna is not going to prevail against it. That's an interesting concept, isn't it? I thought I had another chart here, but I don't. All right, so look at verse 18 with me. When I grew up, what I was taught is that, and maybe I wasn't a very good listener and didn't understand, but in verse 18, the idea was, here's the church, and the forces of Satan are going to be bearing down on the church, and the church isn't going to get smaller. Does that sound familiar to anybody? I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. You've got the church, the kingdom of God. You've got God's rule, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. It's the kingdom that is expanding, pushing back the forces of Satan. It's the kingdom on the offensive, not on the defense, saying, okay, all right, you're not going to prevail against us. You're not going to hurt us or destroy us. Rather, Jesus is saying there is going to be no stop to God's rule. And I think that's what he's describing here. A lot to think about if this isn't how we view this. Any questions? Good. No questions. Excellent. It's a lot here. And I appreciate you walking through this with me. The tone in Jesus has changed. And it's really more focused on the disciples while he's here in this area, in Caesarea Philippi. And here in verses 21 through 23, he makes his first of three predictions that he is going to go to Jerusalem and be killed and then raised from the dead. We've just read about Peter's magnificent confession and Jesus' response, "You are Peter, upon this rock I will build my church." Now let's read verses 21 through 23. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter, the rock, took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." Jesus turned to the rock and said, "Get behind me, Satan! You are a stumbling block to me, a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man's interests." This is one of the reasons why I love Peter so much, because sometimes he can get it oh so right. And then he can, in the same moment, get it oh so wrong. And I feel like sometimes I get it right. And then I blow it. Just mess up royally. Can anybody else relate to that? Maybe you can relate to that because your husband is the same way too. I don't know. What do you think about this? There's a lot here too. There's no crowds around, it's just the disciples, often Caesarea Philippi. And Jesus says, "All right, it's time. I need to let them know what's going on." And what's so especially important about the first prediction is it's recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All three synoptic gospels record Jesus' first prediction of his death. The second prediction is also recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the third prediction, there's three of them, is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. What does that tell you? Well, number one, John didn't record them. But number two, what does it tell you about these predictions? They're important. All three synoptic gospels record all three predictions. And Jesus gives them a little more detail each time. When Jesus tells the disciples, "I'm going to die. I'm going to be raised from the dead." Did you see that there? "On the third day be raised," verse 21. And Peter says, no. "That is not going to happen to you." Why did Peter respond that way? Jesus is the Christ. He's supposed to suffer. Isaiah predicts it. His emotions got in his way. How about this? Obviously his emotions got in his way, and that's absolutely correct. Maybe Peter doesn't really understand in the first place. He thinks he understands. All right, you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man's interests. Peter is still thinking physically, physical Messiah. Some warrior king who's going to come in and wipe Rome off the map and elevate Jerusalem and the throne of David. And Peter is still thinking fleshly. So how in the world do you go from, "You are the rock, and I will build my church upon your rock bed confession," to, "Get behind me, Satan"? Did Peter just forget? Let his emotions get the best of him, sure. But I think also, fundamentally, he does not really understand. Bless you. All right. We've got one more section this morning. The coming of the Son of Man and judgment. We're not going to talk about the transfiguration today. We will spend a lot of time talking about the transfiguration next Sunday. But this is really, really important, this confession that Jesus makes. Oh, you know what? And I forgot to ask something. I was spending so much time on the previous section. Why did people think Jesus was maybe John the Baptist? I mean, wasn't John the Baptist still alive? Well, no. Matthew 14. John the Baptist is dead. Why would people think that if John the Baptist was dead, he could be Jesus, raised from the dead, resuscitated? In fact, Herod Antipas feared that about Jesus. What about Elijah? Why would they think Jesus was Elijah? Right. Yeah, that Elijah would come before the coming of the king, before the coming of the Lord. Who was, in fact, the Elijah type? And that was John. Why Jeremiah? Jeremiah was famous for declaring judgment against the temple and against Jerusalem, warning it's coming. He has this scathing temple sermon, and it's referred to a couple of times by Jesus. We haven't gotten to the most scathing, but he will be talking about judgment against the temple. Jesus loved the temple. Anytime he was in Jerusalem, he wanted to be at the temple, but he also sharply rebuked the temple. I don't know all the reasons why, but that in itself is important, and we ought to explore it. Why was Jesus being considered to be Jeremiah specifically? That's really interesting. By the way, Jeremiah, in Jeremiah 31 through 34, as quoted in Hebrews 8 through 12, good, important passage, quoted verbatim in the New Testament, talks about the new covenant. And Jeremiah did not inaugurate the new covenant. He predicted it. Well, Jesus is the one who inaugurated it. He is the lawgiver. Like Moses gave the law of Moses, as it's called, Jesus inaugurated the replacement, or the fulfillment, I should say, the fulfillment. So there's a lot going on here all of a sudden. Not that there aren't in other passages, but this just seems to be particularly full of key important elements that I wanted us to slow down and take a look at. All right, let's read this last section together. I didn't finish verses 24 through 26, did I? I guess I got to go back. Folks, I had LASIK surgery a number of years ago, and it's been a blessing. Just love it. I got an eye appointment this week. I'm getting old, and I can't see the print up there on my little monitor, and so I'm trying to follow along. So, oh yeah, that's a six, not a three. I just assumed it was a three because that's the passage I'm familiar with. All right, verse 24, as we still focus on this idea of Jesus' prediction and dying. And so he passes it on. He says he's going to die. But take a look at verses 24 through 26. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? What will a man give in exchange for his soul?" How does that relate to verses 21 through 23? By means of the cross. He doesn't specifically mention the cross here, but he will in the second and third predictions. But here he is saying, I'm gonna die. And then in the same breath, he says, the one who wants to save his life is actually going to do the very opposite. He's going to lose his life by denying me. And the one who is willing to give up his life in that act, through God's grace, he will save his life. It further solidifies who he is. What do you mean by that? So we have to give up our lives just as freely, don't we? Paul, Galatians 2, verse 20 says, it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. I've been crucified with Christ. I'm not the one who's alive anymore. I'm living for the Lord. That sounds a lot like this description of a Christian, doesn't it? Of a disciple, more specifically. Well, now Jesus is going to talk about judgment. Verses 27 and 28. For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father. And then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Well, you thought we had a lot of controversial material to cover earlier. Guess what? Verse 28 is one of these passages we scratch our heads over and say, what exactly is Jesus talking about? I want you to notice on the screen that Matthew 16, 27 and 28 parallels with Mark 8, verse 38 through chapter 9, verse 1. Let's take a moment and take a look at Mark 8. And I mention this because when you're reading the Gospels on your own, and you come along here to this section, I want you to remember that this is an awkward chapter break. Chapters and verses are our fantastic tool, a reference system. They just work great. But sometimes they didn't get it right. These are human people who, non-inspired folks who made the chapters and verses for the New Testament. All right, Mark 8, verse 38 and chapter 9, verse 1 go together. In fact, in my Bible, there's no heading above chapter 9. You would think, normally, you come to chapter 9, okay, something new is coming. And I'm emphasizing this because Matthew and Luke, the way their chapter divisions are, they all go together. So I've got I have an observation I want to make. What's the next section? What's the next event that takes place starting in Mark 9, verse 2? The Transfiguration, which we will get to next week. And so I highlighted it in green. But right now, we're going to take a look at this very interesting statement that Jesus makes. In fact, Jesus adds something in verse 38 of Mark. It reads a little differently than what we just read in Matthew 16. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Studying the parallels between these passages is utterly fascinating. And Matthew doesn't mention at all anything about being ashamed of me. Now, it's implied where Jesus is saying those who confess me, I'm going to reward them. But here he specifically talks about this adulterous and sinful generation. That's the kind of language that Jeremiah would be using, that the prophets use to describe Judah. And then he says this, I say to you, there are some standing here right now who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. What is Jesus referring to? All right, one possibility is he's referring to the crucifixion and resurrection. Would that be in the lifetime of some of the people who are there? Yes. What else could it be? Okay, well, Pentecost. Okay, and maybe it's referring to the establishment of the church in Acts 2. Could it be the Transfiguration? Seeing will not taste it until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. I don't know. Let me go back to Matthew. I thought it was just somewhat glory. Let me look at that. No, it's also coming in his kingdom. I think it's probably referring to the resurrection. I think what Julie said first is probably what it's referring to. I don't know for sure. This is a different tone with Jesus, don't you think? He's really getting people's attention and focusing on this is what's coming up next. Now, it's going to be several months. It's going to be, let's see here. He's going to spend about 3 months in Judea after this, another 3 months in Perea, and then a week. So we're looking at 6 months out for the crucifixion, I guess really 7 months out. Who is going to remember this statement? Some are standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. I think the disciples would, for sure. We think of Jesus as our king, and well, we should. When did he become our king? When God created us. God is the king of all the universe. Jesus took a submissive role, and my understanding as I read the Gospels and the letters, I think Jesus was declared officially to be our king through the line of David, physical descendancy through the line of David, by his resurrection and ascension. And that's when he became officially King Jesus. And 1 Corinthians 15 talks about Jesus having the kingdom and will one day give it back to the Father. Jesus is our king. And he rules on earth. And his gospel is not going to be destroyed by the forces of Satan. In Matthew 17, or as we go on in Mark 9, we're going to see Jesus transfigured. And there is a tremendous scene here where Jesus' glory is shown. And that's why we're going to spend a special session, our last class this quarter, on the transfiguration. Who is Jesus focusing on right now since he went to Caesarea Philippi, his disciples? What has he told them? Has he told them some things he has never told them before? You say no? They're not getting it. They haven't really been paying attention. But this whole idea about the keys of the kingdom, that is new. And what has been bound, you'll be binding. Jesus is talking about their work after he leaves. And he's beginning to focus more on him not being with them physically and them continuing his work. And I think that's important for us to see. He's getting them ready for after their resurrection. Did the apostles understand what Jesus was talking about? Most of the time. But after the resurrection, when they saw Jesus dead, they saw him alive, fully resuscitated, it clicked. It began to make perfect sense to them. Now, if I had been Peter, would I have understood what Jesus was intending? Yes. Mark the Apostle said, "You are the Christ, the Son of God." And he never would have rebuked Jesus, and he would have gotten it every step of the way. What do you think, honey? She said yes. All right, folks. I have really enjoyed going through this with you. Tonight, Larry will be here. And here is the application we're going to focus on. Getting away with God. Jesus takes his disciples. He shifts them up to Caesarea Philippi. Gets away from anything and everything. And he focuses on them. He will focus on his relationship with them and with God. And I'm excited to sit in the class tonight. And I hope you'll be back at 5 o'clock for that special study. Thank you. I think we raised more questions than we answered this morning.